Hello, hello, what is happening? Welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and thanks for all the love. Part one of a conversation with Dr. Michael Gervais was awesome. The feedback was as good as any podcast we've had, and I think people really dug the insight he gave on his path towards high-performance psychology, how he feels about high-stakes environments, and of course, his experience with the Elite 11, which you can check that documentary out. Feature doc, almost 11 million views combined on social media at elite11.com. You can see it all at yogiroth.com. But here comes part two of our conversation. So let me set the stage. We're in his office. We're overlooking Hermosa Beach. We finish our convo. It's like, all right, let's get a workout in. We go to this hot yoga class in Soho Yoga. I highly recommend it in Hermosa Beach. And it just kicks the you-know-what out of both of us. But we loved it. Class ends. We go right back to his office. We hit record and dive right into this conversation. And when I was in yoga class, you know, like we do after sometimes performances, whether it's games or interviews or presentations, I was thinking about all the things that I wish I asked and making these mental notes, probably not very present in that yoga practice specifically, but I wanted to get back, hit record as quickly as possible. And we dive in. He talks about his vision in life, his philosophy, what lights him up. Shrinking versus going for it, vulnerability. He dives into his flame, what he hopes it is, his opinion on grit, which I think you'll love, and much, much more. So dive in, Mike Gervais, part two of two in the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm loving it. Thanks for the love and the reviews and all that good stuff. Keep it coming. Much love. And here we go. Part two, Dr. Mike. All right. Welcome back, Life Without Limits podcast. Mike Gervais, this is part two, Mike. We knocked out part one. It was a strong conversation. We had a lot of depth. And then, of course, we took a break, went to yoga class. And like to enlighten the listeners, how was that for you?
Yeah. It was hard. It was about 105 degrees, and I was shaking almost the entire time.
Domination. Are you a yoga fan?
Not really.
No? Why do you do it?
What I like is, you know, figuring out where my edge is, and that does it for me. And so, like, when I think of yoga as a community, there's parts of every community that I really love and like, and there's parts that drive me nuts. And so I say not really, like, that's what I would say to most communities. So
fair. Okay. All right. So we're going to roll and set the setting right now. Here we are, beautiful Hermosa Beach, part two of the Life Without Limits podcast with Dr. Gervais. And Mike, I want to just hit you with questions on this, okay? Give me your quick responses. We'll get in, we'll get out, we'll call it a day, all right?
Sounds great.
First question.
If you like to be rushed.
First question. How do you think people will perceive you?
Serious.
Yeah.
Intense. And then the people that know me really well know that I'm kind of quirky and like silly. And so I think that, but most people would just instantly say intense.
And how do you feel people react to you when you walk into the room for the first time, knowing your reputation? Here comes the high performance psychologist.
Oh, I don't know. I've actually never even really thought like that. Maybe that's good to think that way. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Do you know?
Well, I think it's interesting. I get to observe as a producer, at least with the Elite 11, when you walk into the room, at first the kids are like, who is this guy? They don't know. Mm-hmm. And then you get introduced as a high-performance psychologist. I'll never forget our first year at Pepperdine. We introduce you, and you give this amazing presentation. It's on YouTube. This was like Jameis Winston's year. And this is the first time, to be honest, that I saw you do your thing. And you have kids get up there, and you do your ABCs 1 through 26. And if anybody hasn't seen it, you can check it out at on Elite 11. Just go to YouTube and put in Elite 11 2012. And it was amazing. These kids can't do it. You have to go A1, B2, C3, and so on and so forth. And as we're walking out, all these kids, I'll never forget, it was Tanner Mangum, starting quarterback at BYU. He turns to me and goes, "Hey, it doesn't look like a psychologist. It doesn't look like a doctor."
Yeah. I don't really think about what they're thinking about me, but I'm always curious to meet people. And I don't know, it just feels normal to me. I don't know another way to think about it.
So how about now? Because you have this really successful podcast. You've done insane in the last 2 years amount of public speaking to companies, corporations. You got a great venture with Coach Carroll where you're talking to corporations about leadership, about finding mastery, about getting better, tapping into your potential. And I think people hang on your words. Do you feel that? And if so, how does that make you feel?
Ooh, I don't know about hanging on words. I think that what it feels like for me is it's a wonderful opportunity to share the things that I've spent my life trying to figure out, and which is about how the mind works in calm moments, rugged moments, hostile moments, and how, what are the methodologies that allow people, myself included, to be able to train and cultivate a mindset that feels right and authentic. And so I know when I'm talking that when I feel aligned, I feel connected to people, and that feels right. And I imagine that they would probably feel something close to that as well. And the only reason that really happens, I think, is when two people are connected on what seems to be true. And so that's what it feels like to me. And which is like, I don't know, it's such a gift. I feel so grateful for the people that allow me to share some thoughts and give time and attention. So that's what it feels like.
You know, what's interesting is an analyst in college football, I look at quarterbacks, and a lot of the times you want to see the guys that can see the really complex stuff and make it really simple, right? And as a coach or as an analyst, I try to do that on air. Take the really complex and make it really simple. I think when you speak, people are like, oh yeah, my God, like it's, I just got to breathe and then I could stop having crazy anxiety attacks. Like,
yeah, I know it is simple like this, but it's really complicated.
There's so much depth,
all the stuff underneath. Somebody that was listening to, a training that I was giving after it was 8 hours. It was a long, it was a long day. And afterwards, he has a PhD in psychology as well. And he said, you found the sweet spot of simple and still maintain the wisdom in it. And I was like, ah, okay. That's what I'm trying. That is essentially it. What I'm hoping to cultivate is make it really simple. And then also never lose the wisdom of the source of where it came from.
What's the vision you have for yourself, for your career, for your life? And do you set that?
Yeah. And we talk a lot about the importance of having a vision. And so, okay, pull back the curtain. Here's where it starts for me, is that I never cared once about working with the best in the world. I never had an interest. I get 4, 5, 6 emails a week. I don't know if that's a lot or normal or whatever, for people that are just starting in the path in performance psychology. And they're saying, one day I want to work with professional and Hall of Fame athletes. And so I have this really standard answer I fire back, which is, that, you know, refine your craft and figure out what you love. That's the path. It's not about working with best. And so I have no interest in, confining my vision to working with best or progressing forward. The vision for my future is to wake up every day and live with vigor and love and keep searching to understand what's true. And that's a day in, day out process. Where it lands me, I'm not really sure. But I want to do that in life with relationships. I want to do it in passions. And I want to do it in business. And I love when all three of those things merge. And the relationships I have with loved ones and people that I care about are all wrapped into, you know, this tribal mentality about figuring it out. And it feels like it's a lifelong quest and one day after another. So that's how I think about vision, is maximizing today.
Yeah, we're sitting in yoga class and just getting absolutely worked, sweating, coming from everywhere. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, I got some real questions, simple questions for Mike. One being, and I cannot believe that, and we started part one off with, I'm only asking questions I don't know the answers to. And I'm kind of embarrassed to say I don't know this answer for you, but I don't know what your life philosophy is. And I know that you subscribe to challenging people to trying to figure out a philosophy in 25 words or less, so much so that I believe that's kind of how you ended the Elite 11 with these quarterbacks, of a challenge to start thinking about life like that. So what is yours?
Okay. So it's pretty simple. Every day we have an opportunity to live. Every day we have the opportunity for a living masterpiece, to create a living masterpiece. So that's how I guide my days by, is that every day is an opportunity. So there's an optimistic frame around it, and it's to create a living masterpiece. And it's the way that anybody, myself, you, anyone listening, can design their life that is a masterpiece for today. And it's a living, breathing, temporary expression of who a person is in any environment that they're in today. So it might seem kind of esoteric, right? But that is my guiding philosophy. And then it's changed, though. There was 5 years ago, it was different. And 5 years ago was I was in a different place and it's evolving. So I think our philosophy doesn't have to be static and it doesn't have to be just absolutely one thing. Maybe if I was, or somebody was like the living incarnate of the greatest God or Jesus or Buddha alive, that it would be simple. And it's probably love.
Yeah.
And it's probably service. And that all seems absolutely right. And it's, for some reason, that's not my philosophy. I love love. I love expressing it and giving it. And I love the part of loving, not knowing and strain and struggle and the dark side and the light side. I love, period. But it's the philosophy for me is that every day is an opportunity to create a living masterpiece.
So I'm just imagining, as you do when, you know, you listen to podcasts or when I'm listening to yours, I'm on a great run in Venice Beach or whatever it may be. And a follow-up question might be, well, how do we define a masterpiece? That's a pretty big word. And isn't that like Van Gogh and, you know, Picasso? Those are the people that do masterpieces.
Yeah. So that would be a masterpiece that is not necessarily living. It is like a sculpture that's static and they stand the test of the ages. And they're amazing. And they've been amazing from inception to all the witnesses from that point forward. So a living masterpiece is aligning thoughts, words, and actions. And that's how I think about a living masterpiece. So when we can cultivate the wherewithal within ourselves to align our thoughts, our words, and our actions in calm, rugged, and hostile environments, where we're able to express artistically our craft by understanding the nuances inside of the space between. Oh my God, what the hell did I just say? But that's it. That's really it. That's what I think about all the time.
Okay. So I'm going to come back to that answer with the follow-up, but I think it's important to, we express the power behind the 25 words or less philosophy. I know you've subscribed to it. I heard it from Coach Carroll when I first got to meet him, and so much so that
that's actually his 25 words or less. I never put bumpers on it, but I feel like, a philosophy are guiding principles that guide your life. You could have 30 sentences.
Right.
You could have 3 words. And the idea of having a clarity of a philosophy is, from clarity, you have the ability to live your life with conviction. So let's get the clarity right first. Right. And that's 25 words. It's probably more like 10.
Yeah. And what I love about that is, you know, I've had people send me emails and be like, I read Win Forever and here's my philosophy in 25 words or less. And my response pretty much every time is, all right, let's break down the first word. Point being, like, there's so much depth that goes into literally every word, every syllable. And that to me is the fun work. I mean, I think I was 22, 23, Mike, and I'm starting my first year out as a broadcaster. And I meet this guy, you know, and he says, all right, yeah, who do you want to be? And I go, oh, I want to be Kirk Herbstreit. He goes, oh, great. Tell me why. Tell me your style, your vision, your theme, and your philosophy around how you want to be this great broadcaster. So I spent all summer doing it, like literally 30, 40 pages. And I come back in. I give this guy the packet and he kind of flips through it kind of arrogantly and just throws it back at me. And he goes, all right, I'll put each one of them in a sentence. And that to me was the first challenge of, okay, you got to go do all this work on what you want your life philosophy to be. You know, it ain't real till you write it down. You really go to work on it and then start to distill from there. Okay. Cause everything that I think we say when it comes to a vision, a philosophy has to have depth. And that's what I love about you. If we ask you a question, I learned this early on, or you ask me a question, Yogi, what lights you up? Which I'm going to ask you in a second. And I would say, probably at that era of my life, it was all about competition. Your follow-up of why would, I don't know. I like games. I like when people compete. I like the fans versus the actual depth that goes into it. So I think there's important to put a button on the philosophy side of thing. But for you, my follow-up is, what does light you up?
Okay, I want to answer that. On the philosophy piece, this is how I think that it gets real, is under duress, knife point, gun point, the most kind of scary dark alley you can imagine. If somebody comes up to you and says, what do you stand for?
Right.
Okay, there you go. Can you get it out? And if you've just done the intellectual exercise of writing, but never moved it to something that's crisp and it's authentic and it's real and it comes from a source within you, and then you've exercised it on day in and day out, that's like 3 layers. The intellectual exercise, the making it crisp and really clear and authentic, and then the 3rd layer is exercising it or training it every day, that it won't be there for you. And so I think that's a really wonderful kind of process to think through. And there's very little science around it. So I just want to be really clear. When we start, as soon as we start talking about philosophy, it's like we're getting into that space of like, what are you really talking about from a science lens? I can't find any research that points to the power of philosophy.
So how do you define philosophy?
Guiding principles.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are the guiding principles that frame up your decision-making process?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, Martin Luther King, he was really clear.
Yeah.
You know, what his was.
So what lights you up, man?
Martin Luther King Jr. Sorry. what lights me up? Insight. I love insight. I love mastery. I love, being on the edge where I'm forced to make some decisions and it's really clear whether I'm shrinking or going for it. And I love being able to share that those processes and see other people light up with it as well. There's such a joy when you're in the trenches working with people and there's a mutual sharing and learning experience. And then one and both or both of you go out and get tested. And in that laboratory of getting tested, you come back and retool and rework and reharness, you know, exactly what we're going for, and then go back out into the world and be tested again. That process, whew, I love it. I love it. And then at the same time, so that's kind of hard, right? There's like a lot of energy involved in that. At the same time, what lights me up are those moments of complete fullness where I find it with my son often, and I find it with Lisa, my wife often, where there's such a fullness of love and emotion that it feels overwhelming. And I know early in my life, I hesitated. I would excuse my way out of it. I would shudder in some kind of way to numb it or to dull it or to not have it be such an explosive experience. And love is and joy. There's a razor's edge to it. And we don't talk about that. We think a razor's edge of like, you know, doing difficult things. And nah, there's something that is really hard about full love. And so that lights me up too, figuring that out.
Anytime I travel,
you're good at that. You tell people you love them all the time, you know? Nice. And so I don't know if you just say it.
No, I mean, I learned that the hard way, you know? I mean, I learned that of not wanting to say it to anything other than a football, you know, that was my first love. So to me, I had to make the transition that maybe a lot of athletes have to make that you've worked with, or maybe they're just around where, I mean, I slept with the football since I was 12 years old. Until I was 22. And then football broke up with me. I didn't break up with football. You know, sports, they kind of tell you when it's over. We always think that, you know, even the greatest, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, I mean, they don't really leave on their own terms, right? Your body breaks down or you're just not gifted enough. So when that left, I had this void and I had to channel it. And to me, that's when I read The Alchemist, you know, and I was like, wow, the language of the world. Like, I don't believe it's Spanish, French, English, Hebrew, Portuguese. Like, I really think it's love. And my next question for you is when I'm traveling all the time, it's so easy to connect. Like you talk the space between, right? The space between commitment and hesitation. And mm-hmm. That's kind of what I capture from you, whether we're out in the water together and it's like, you're busting my chops. And why didn't you go for that, dude? And I just kind of passed up because I hesitated because it got a little big there at the end. But when I'm on the road, there's zero hesitation, you know, at all. It's the most natural thing in the world. And whenever I come home, the analogy I like to often use is I walk into Whole Foods in Venice Beach, like the epicenter of beauty, creativity, perceived love, and nobody's talking to anybody. And it's hesitation left and right because you're drawn into somebody like, whoa, I kind of want to say hi to that person. Or oh, that person seems pretty interesting. And in the streets of Rome, it's happening. When you hear that story, I'm curious selfishly what your observation is.
Which part?
I think, well, I guess both, I guess, from the absolute freedom in a far off place.
Well, when I hear that, I'm not sure if that's your freedom,
right?
That you've created the space to explore. And because of that, you're less encumbered by the busyness and the role that you're supposed to be donning by, you know, day in and day out life in Los Angeles or wherever we're talking in the States. And so I'm not sure if it's you or if it's the environment,
right?
You know, I'm not sure if it's the culture attributes or it's your experience or lenses on it. So that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. Cause I think I like the analogy of the razor's edge. Mm-hmm. Cause I do, there is the dark side, which can be beautiful as you reference. And I think that when we get into places of comfort, we don't want to use the razor, you know? And I think that is, I see that in sports. I think I see that in life and it's a bummer, right? So my next question, how do you, if somebody's out there saying, man, I love playing big, I want to play big, but I can't get over that hump. What would you tell somebody?
So they want to go for it in something.
Yeah. Right?
And they keep playing it small or safe.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It's like, you know that I'm going to pause at that because one is I don't give advice. I find that unbecoming to give advice to somebody because we need to understand their journey. We need to understand their path, their framework. And they know within themselves the path forward. They've had success in this thing that's they're stuck in now. And it goes back to that earlier part of our conversation on part one, where if you tell somebody what to do, then they have to look to the next person or you again for that insight. No, it's in that person. It's in me for my insight. So I want relationships where people, you know, either they play Columbo or they, you know, they're really asking intelligent questions about how to clear away some of the darkness so that the insight can be revealed. So I don't know. I don't know what I would say to that person because I don't know the path, but I would suggest that one lesson I've learned from people that are completely skilled in the risk environments, completely skilled in those environments, is that there's more pain in having an idea and not going for it than going for it and getting bruised or losing money or losing reputation or even in the most extreme cases, life. So the pain of knowing and not going is far greater.
Can you remember the last time you didn't go?
Oh, every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, every day. There's something every day where, like today we just did class and my heart was pounding and my ears started to go. When my ears go and they get that little ring in there and then the next thing happens, I get this cotton mouth. I don't know if you were there or not, but that happens for me. And when that happens for me, I'm compelled to want to take a knee. Right. And because I know that I'm about to pass out. Right. And so I got almost right to that place where the cotton mouth started happening and the white, and I just stopped. I probably had three more reps in me that I could have done. So, but yeah, so it happens every day where there's like places where I'm playing it a little bit safer than I'd like to. And there's plenty of places and there's plenty of opportunities every day that I'm doing better than I did the day before, the month before. So, I just learned to be aware and to keep maximizing, as best I can without being critical, you know, just having an appreciation for the journey as opposed to nailing everything all the time.
Right.
We can do that. We could be successful at everything we do. We'd just be playing basketball against third graders.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways,
no, I think that's important for people to hear. Because at least as your reputation has continued to grow, I think people, oh, Mike's always going for it. That's just, he lives his high performance life. And I think it's important to know that a high performance life, and tell me if this is accurate in your definition, isn't always about hitting every jump shot. You know, it's just shooting it. It's taking it and learning that when you don't, that's okay. You know, just being aware of when you don't.
It's a funny story. This is just a couple months ago. I was fortunate enough to be in Hawaii, staying at a mutual friend's house of ours.
Amazing house, by the way.
Amazing house, right on the North Shore, right on the sand. And one of the, you know, it's like maybe one day. It's gorgeous. And so it was huge. The surf was flat out big. And I hadn't been in surf that had tested me at that size for a long time. And I was not in surf condition. And the first thing that goes is this little tiny muscle on the back of your shoulders. And when that muscle goes and there's fatigue that hits there and you're winded out in the wild ocean, like a lot of thoughts go through your mind. And so, what am I doing? But so I could have turned in and gone inside, but I kept going and kept going. I paddled out. I got out to the back and it's big. And, 2 days earlier, it's the biggest that Hawaii ever gets. They ran the eddy, which is when it's, you know, 35 feet or more. And I'm out back. There's like two or three other guys out there. And so I'm sitting out there. My arms are frying. My shoulders are on fire. I'm winded. It took me much longer than I thought to get out. And I'm sitting out back by myself and a wave comes in. And I thought to myself, yeah, not a shot, not a chance. I can take a shot here. Like it would have been bad for me to go of how out of shape I was at that moment. And then, so I waited for I kind of paddled over that wave and there was another one right behind it and I was completely alone. I said, okay, here we go. Like we gotta go. And so I turned, I paddled into it. I'm scratching in and I can feel all of the ocean's energy kind of lifting me up. I'm right in the right place and I'm completely engaged and there's no thoughts about it. I pop up, I land on my feet and God bless it. If my feet weren't just like pegged I was just like two straight-legged pegs kind of skipping down the wave. And I did everything I could by hook and crook to be able to just stay on my board. And it was a disaster. It was an absolute disaster. And so I had no rhythm, nothing. And it was just a really great reminder that there's only three things as humans we can train. You can train your body, your craft, and your mind. So my mind was right. My body was not. And I couldn't access my craft. It's kind of that simple in the world of, you know, performance where we're doing something with our body. And
I love that. Yeah. That's such a great analogy. So, all right. So I want to hit you with a couple words and we'll get out of here. I'd love to hear your reaction to them. Your first thought.
Sure.
Surfing.
Love.
I love that. You just have to pause and honor that word for a second, regardless if you're good or bad or a pro or a rook. There's something that when you have no power.
Yeah, it's a bit tapping in and harnessing. And what's great about surfing is that, not to be cliche about any of this, but it's every wave is brand new.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a great analogy. No two waves are alike, right? Every wave is brand new. It's a great analogy for every moment is brand new. And when you figure out how to be in the rhythm of this moment, to be on time for this moment, we end up stringing many moments together. And that's where we get the insights about how we work, how the world works. It's the ability to string moments together and being on time. So surfing was a great teacher for that and is a great teacher. Sport can be a great teacher. And it's an even better teacher when there's high stakes, because if you're not fully present, the nature of high stakes forces us to be present. Right. And so if we can translate that skill of being present into other ventures, then it's wonderful. There is nothing more important than sitting and listening. Just listening, following breathing, watching thoughts without judgment. It's such an accelerated path to insight. Insight will not come from reading more books.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of surfing is when you get out of the water and you look at it, you're like, oh, wow, it's not that big. I got it. And then you get in it and you're like, oh my God, this is the biggest thing in the world. And you get out and you're like, oh, wow, I just did that. Or I'm terrible. I can't believe I couldn't surf that. Like, it's the constant battle in your own mind and you're never going to win. Like, if you think it's a competition, like, you have zero chance.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a little tangent, but we had to give a little homage to that word. A phrase that you exposed me to, Mike, simple joys.
Yes.
Where'd that come from?
That was from, there was a gentleman, Terry Orlick, sports psychologist. And there was this wonderful gathering of the passing of kind of wisdoms from a generation, I think it was the second generation of sports psychologists to the next generation. And I was honored to be part of that passing of the torch experience. It was a wonderful exchange. And there was a gentleman there named Terry Orlick, Dr. Orlick. And God bless it. I mean, he's soulful and he's on it. And we ended up meeting each other and having a wonderful email correspondence back and forth. He lives up in Canada. And that's how he signed it. And so I said, similar to what, you know, you just said, is I emailed him and I said, I love this phrase. And he said, great. You know, and so that's paying it forward. That's where I got it from.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir. Vulnerability.
Challenging. Required.
Do you think that is the word that allows for the greatest growth?
Well, there's a fine line between vulnerability and openness. Mm. And I love vulnerability. I love what it stands for. And vulnerability, though, happens in the face of other people. That's how we think about vulnerability. And it's not always the right thing. So it is required to have the capacity to be vulnerable, but it's not always right, because if you're in the presence of other people and you become vulnerable and you express something openly, and there's a difference between the two, it's not always a good decision. Right. And so I think that it is necessary for growth with the right people in the right environments. And sometimes you're going to lead people and environments and show them how to be vulnerable. And sometimes the environments and people in it will teach you how to be vulnerable as well. So I think it's difficult and challenging and required.
A couple of years ago, you gave a talk. I don't even remember where, but I was there and I love this. And have adapted it to my life. I believe that we are attracted to people whose flames are charging. And I think we all have one, you know, and sometimes it, you know, is a little less. Sometimes we got to find a new log. Sometimes we got to completely flip over the fire. I'd love to know how you would describe your flame.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to think that it's like just like raging. You know, I'd like to think that. And okay, so that feels good. Like as an image would be, it's a campfire, you know, and it's a healthy size. And you know, the image, it's not like an inferno. It's like a campfire that's got a healthy kind of glaze to it. There's some embers that kind of kick off wildly every once in a while. And I'd like to think that that there's a gathering around it. That's how I'd like to think about it.
I'm going to challenge you on this one to see how concise you can be. Okay. On the word grit.
Does that mean short or concise?
No, that means concise. How would you describe the word grit? I mean, this is a hot topic. Everybody uses it incorrectly, correctly, who knows, but it's thrown around all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We said concise. Well, let me give you the definition.
Go for it.
Yeah. Let's just start with the definition. According to Angela Duckworth, who coined the phrase, is that it's passion and perseverance for long-term goals. And I like to think about it as doing the difficult and boring for an extended period of time. It's like, it's doing the stuff now for some sort of experience that you'll have later. That's kind of what grit is about. And I don't mean payoff like as an outcome, but the payoff is the understanding or the mastery or the expression of something you didn't understand now. So you're willing to do the difficult, the boring, and have, you know, inside of deliberate, focused practices, the self-control to continue to stay in those challenging moments. And so grit as a prerequisite or part and parcel of people that understand mastery, that understand achievement, which would, to me feels like a couple notches below mastery. But yeah, so that's how I think about grit. And I think it's also irresponsible to talk about grit without talking about the importance of recovery. And so if grit is doing work, then recovery on the world stage, we talk more about recovery and the science of recovery than we do about working hard, because everyone's already interested in working hard. And so the conversation is about intelligent work and more than anything else, the science of recovery, so that you can get up again tomorrow and have enough vigor and fire, and you can have enough of that inner spirit to do the difficult and boring, because one, you love the difficult and boring because that's where the space between is found.
I love that. How do you feel about the word limits?
Well, I don't know what they are. And so it feels like there is, there's a fence up when we talk about limits in my mind. Like I think about borders and I don't know what the limits of the human experience are. And people are amazing. The human condition and race is just phenomenal. And we are so much more than the neurological chemistry. We're so much more than the muscle and skeletal system. The mind and the spirit and this invisible software or whatever however we're going to call consciousness or the ability to think and to be aware of the thinking, it is amazing because there's no center of where thought comes from. So when you asked earlier about being lit up is what you said, this is also part of it, is like, can we figure out how the invisible works? It's invisible now. At one point, I'd love for this challenge. I did a conversation. I did a talk at Nike a number of years back, and the talk was about observation of thought. Where is it? Where's the origin? Where does it go? How much does it weigh? What happens to it before it happens, after it happens? Like, you know, at some point, we're going to be able to see and organize and manage thought. We can't see it now, and it feels complicated. And that's why, like, advice giving feels dangerous. And, you know, coaching somebody through something feels dangerous. A right. Great relationship with a rich understanding of the person and the science of all of the theory and research that supports it provides context for accelerated growth. So I don't know. I'm off on a tangent.
How do you see thought? How do you project us to be able to see thought?
We don't know. We don't know yet. We're starting to be able, not me, but the collective science community is finding through fMRI and through some beautiful imaging that's taking place, like the epicenter of thought.
Wow.
And that thought precedes movement, and where in the brain and the neural pathways that the origins of thought are happening, and kind of how fast thought moves or impulses move through the thalamic gate. And that's like the thalamus in the brain. And yeah, the brain is so freaking complicated, and we can see it. So I don't know. I don't know anyone in the space of the brain where they understand what the hell they're talking about. And they say it like, we don't know. It's 3 pounds of silly putty and this sits in the base of our skull that is phenomenal. And so this is a wonderful, wonderful time right now. And the wonderment is science is on point. There's an interest in better, doing better and living better and having meaning in life. And, you know, we're running through our environment. We are blazing through our environment in a way that we're not honoring the thing that's giving us life and sustainability. And there's a consciousness about it. There's an awareness about it. You know, global warming is real and it's happening. And so this is a really exciting time. And that excitement is, I don't know how to not be switched on about it. And I'm not sure that when people talk about being depressed, it's like, there's such like a frustration that I get with that, because there's so much amazing that's taking place. And I understand the neurochemistry of depression and that it's thought-based and organic-based. You can be born with predispositions for it. But man, there's some really important stuff to be able to pay attention to and to help others on their journey. On a little asterisk, those of us that suffer, you know, with anxiety or depression or whatever, helping other people research has found is as effective as medication for moderate depression.
Oh,
nice little kind of thought, right? Whenever you're feeling blue, get out of your own way and get back, get with someone, right. You know, help them. There you go.
I love that. All right. So I'd like to, as we put a button on this podcast, man, what in your life, if you could, let's just imagine, your chart for the next X amount of years. And you find yourself just living on the North Shore, you're just crushing waves, you're not hesitating ever on the North. I mean, you're like the dude over there now. What do you hope that someone who comes across, whether it's one of your podcasts, one of your talks, meets you in the coffee shop, or has a great relationship with you, what do you hope that the consistent thought about Mike Gervais is?
Oh, geez, I didn't know where you're going. And then with that, I don't care. Yeah, I don't care about that. I don't care. I hope that, like, let's say that somebody has listened to something or read something, or I think that all of us are like placeholders or emblems for something. Like people that we know and people that we haven't met yet or maybe never meet, it's like they're a placeholder for a part of us that's already inside of us. And I would hope that maybe I'm a placeholder for people that there's a natural attraction for love and for awareness and for thoughtfulness and for you know, the appreciation for truth and being skilled enough in mind to excel on the razor's edge. And so I know that's a lot, but I'd hope that that's kind of the, I don't know what to me being switched on feels like. And we got to do that groundwork to be able to, you know, have meaning and purpose and help the world in a better way. And then I've got a friend of mine in the back of my mind right now that he's actually in the front of my mind now that is saying, who do you think you are?
Right.
To be able to help somebody. And I love that thought, right? Like who does anybody think that they are to help another person? We barely got to get myself right. You know, and so I have such respect for the process of insight and the path to understand oneself so that you can be there to help with whatever challenge somebody else is going through. Because if I'm trying to figure out my stuff, I can't be there to help you. So anyways, there are a couple tangents in there, but I think the spirit was close.
I love that. So Mike, how can people stay connected with you?
Well, let's see. Finding Mastery has been fun. So it's a Finding Mastery podcast, and they can go to findingmastery.net. I don't know what I'm doing, and you've taught me much of the social media stuff. So at Michael Gervais, and so that's on Twitter. And then I think Instagram is the same thing, at Michael Gervais. Yeah. So those would be the three places.
I love it. Well, dude, I love doing this. I mean, we've had so many conversations, and purposely, I haven't really had a lot of people that I consider like super close friends have podcasts with, because you know so much about them, you know, and it's challenging in terms of, usually you know, you've done a bunch of these interviews, done over 30 of them, you prepare, you've got your list of questions for you. I was like, man, I really want to ask him things I don't know. So I appreciate the honesty, man. You've always been that way. And hopefully we'll do it again.
Okay. So we're not getting off yet.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Can we get, what do you got?
What do you love?
To me, it's life. Like I went through the philosophical exchange of, you know, I went through the work with Pete when I was coaching at SC, and you, every year you do it and he's on it. And for me, he was on me in incredible ways that I'm ridiculously gracious of. And every summer I recheck that. What is it? What is it? What is it? And the last 2 years, it's been such a simple shift that I love to live a full life. And that to me, there's a ton of depth to that, but in a concise way, that is what I hope I am about.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
All right, brother. Thank you for everything. Love being your friend. Love being a friend to you. And thank you for everything.
No doubt. Well, everybody's going to watch you on the Elite 11 documentary. We're not going to tell you what the title of it is. You're going to see it when it comes out. But you were awesome with that. Quarterbacks loved you. We love you. Thanks, bro.
All right, bro.
How much fun was that, man? That was cool. I hope that you all enjoyed it as much as we did. I'd love to know from you on social if you can tell how much fun we were having. I mean, it was a grin session. You know, I love going there with somebody who you can learn from, but also one of my closest friends. And that was just an absolute blast to ask him questions I didn't know the answers to. I think it's fun when we go down those lists of questions at the end, because now we're over 20 podcasts on this journey, and a variety of different answers specifically to vulnerability, to love, to, you know, people describing their flame, to what they think it means to be human, but all in the same genre and all about going for it. And that's been the point of this conversation, right, of exploring what it means to be human. And I think it means to go for it. And for Mike, you know, tons of takeaways from both of those podcasts. For me, the idea that every day we wake up and have an opportunity to create a living masterpiece is a conscious choice. You wake up, you meditate, have your coffee, read your paper, but you get to make a choice. And further, I think the idea of in opportunity, do we shrink or do we go for it? As kids, I think we went for it. I wonder what we do now. And to me, that's a challenge I'd love to throw out there, to dive into yourselves of when opportunity arises, do you shrink? I have. I'm sure we all have. Or do we play big and try to get bruised up a little bit and enjoy that like Dr. Gervais talked about? So thanks for the love. Give us a review. Check out Mike Finding Mastery, his podcast, or on social media at Michael Gervais. And as we love to end this conversation, as always, the only limits that we have are the ones we set ourselves. Peace.